The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the big thing to mention is that we would like to dedicate all the dana, the donations that come today, towards the helping situation in Burma. And the organization that we'd like to support is an organization called the Foundation for the People of Burma. And this was started more or less, maybe it's a little bit not quite right, but it's close enough. It was a foundation or organization that was started on a retreat, on a meditation retreat, a Vipassana retreat. It's really quite something that he's managed to do. And women's empowerment, children protection and safety, community development. The challenge is to get help into Burma, as we see now. I mean, this is not news to people who've been doing this work for a long time, that it's difficult to get aid in. And there's a lot of kind of creative ways that people develop, small ways, kind of grassroots ways to bring money in, help. And I don't know the details of how the Foundation for the People of Burma do it, but I know other organizations that have had relatively creative ways. if any of you have been to Burma, it's quite something to try to work with exchanging your money legally. You know, people should actually be legal, do things legally, right? That's basically usually a good thing to do. But the difference between what the government banks will give you for the dollar versus what it's really worth in Burma is astronomical. And so it's, you know, no one in their right mind would go to the government bank to change the money. So everyone in their right mind expects you to go down the street, you know, to the alley or something. And, you know, these little shops or something, and you exchange your money there. And it's just kind of what's expected. So to give you an example, I was there 23 years ago in Burma. And to give you an example of the kind of things that can happen with your money, if you're not careful, is they don't print a lot of bills in Burma, and they don't print high denomination bills. And so I think the highest denomination bill when I was there was something like 100 kyat, and 100 kyat was about $1.50, as I remember, something. It was very little. And so if you didn't trust the government banks, you kept your bills at home, but you had to have a lot of bills. And one day, one night, the government decided that all the 100 kyat bills and 50 kyat bills, whatever, would no longer be valid. Just like that. And so all these people who kept their money at home, they now had toilet paper. And it was kind of a disaster. And when I was there 23 years ago, it was a very poor country. And it was quite something. I kind of felt when I was in Rangoon, it was kind of like stepping back into 1950, because all the cars were from 1950, almost all of them, a lot of them. And the buildings, you know, last time they really built any buildings in 1950 was 1950 or so. And so it's like everything came to a stop so many years ago. In some ways it was kind of nostalgic, kind of had a nice feeling to it, but it was also, you know, amazingly poor country, a country that was a major rice exporter. Not only couldn't grow enough rice for themselves, but the rice we'd eat was very poor quality rice, dirty, broken, you know, I don't know. So even part of the motivation to support Burma is one of gratitude. For me, I went there in 1985 to practice. I was there for 8 months. And I felt I was a guest of the country, of the people there. I wouldn't say a guest of the state, but I was the guest of the country. And I was there in Burma. It was very difficult back then to get into Burma. And in fact, just before I got a visa, it had actually been closed to Westerners to come. periodically they closed the borders down. And they just opened up again. And so I applied for a visa, and it took 8 months to get that visa. And finally I got the visa, and it's the only country I know that issues meditation visas. Where you can get a visa specifically to go to meditate. Because otherwise, back when I went, you could only get a one-week tourist visa. They wanted you in and out of the country quickly. But the exception was you can get these three-month meditation visas. But the agreement was you don't leave the monastery. Almost don't leave it. You stay there. And so basically I was in Burma without being in Burma. I was there in the monastery for pretty much the whole time. But while I was there, I felt I was really a guest of the country, the people there. And no one ever asked me for any money whatsoever. No one charged anything for me. I was stayed in the monastery for free, had my own room, they fed me this food, wonderful food, except that mostly seemed like all the vegetables and dishes were all served in bowls of oil. And so you pick it out and I try to shake out oil. anything we needed, anything I needed in order to practice there, was given to me freely, including medical care. So if there was some kind of medical problem, the impression I had was the best medical doctors in Rangoon, for the medical kind of schools, would come to see us. I remember once I was sitting, minding my own business, meditating, not doing anything, not moving, not doing anything. Suddenly, one of my cavities just dropped in my mouth. That's kind of unusual. It wasn't like I was biting something hard. Just maybe the temperature change was part of it. Anyway, so then I, they brought a dentist in to see me at the monastery. Clothes, medicine, food, whatever. It was quite something. You really felt we were so supported, so like guests. And these are people so dirt poor, really, really poor. And they were so inspired by people coming to meditate. Burma, for all its difficulties with the government, is overall a very devout Buddhist country. And a lot of people there are very devout. Many people will go to monasteries for vacation. So when I was there, it was a really big monastery I was in. It was kind of like the size of maybe a small junior college. At one point there were 5,000 people there meditating. And then in springtime, there was spring break from school, and we had several thousand kids who came to be temporarily ordained as monks and nuns. And it was really cute to see these kids with shaved heads and these, robes and lined up by size. Walking, hundreds of them, walking around that do some meditation and get some kind of teaching, and it seemed pretty nice. And there were hundreds of these kind of monasteries around Burma, and the only kind of political power in Burma outside the military is the Buddhist monks, and that's why historically for the last 40 years, the government has been very leery of the Buddhist monastic order. Because it's the only power center outside of themselves. So when I was there, I was told by the abbot that there was a government spy. One spy was there only to spy on the Westerners who were there to meditate. So I imagine that was the most boring job of any spy ever. He opened his eyes. it's kind of a privilege to have a spy watching over you. Part of the gratitude, not only the way in which the Burmese took care of many of us who practiced there, but also the way in which Burma is really kind of still a very fertile soil for Buddhist practice and for the development and continuation of Buddhist practice. And the kind of Buddhist practice that's come here to the West, the Vipassana practice that we do at IMS, at Spirit Rock, and here, owes a lot to the way that meditation practice was fostered and developed and taught in Burma in the last century. And, you know, it's come here to this country. Now it's affected thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of people in this country. And it's even gone into kind of secular approaches. You know, the whole John Kabat-Zinn style of mindfulness was very much inspired by his practice at IMS, Insight Meditation Center Society, and which came very much from what was developed in Burma. So this kind of lineage comes out to us. And I would venture to say that we wouldn't be here as a group. I wouldn't be here teaching in Redwood City, in the peninsula, if I hadn't gone to Burma, received the opportunity to practice there and receive those teachings there. I'd be doing something else today. You know? So, you know, our very existence as a group is really contingent or dependent upon the support or the indirect support we've received from this wonderful country. And so there's a number of people in our Vipassana tradition who have devoted themselves to try to help out of gratitude and appreciation, help the situation in Burma. And so it's small, it's grassroots, it's nothing like, you know, what some of these large organizations can do. But it's very effective in the local grassroots level. And so Steve Armstrong, who's a Vipassana teacher in Hawaii, him and his partner Kamala started a foundation, and they go in and do things in very much in a kind of local place with the help of the local monasteries and the local village people, and build schools and hospitals and a variety of things. And they've done a number of schools. They go in and build the schools because the government's not going to build schools for people, apparently. So they, you can build a school for very little money. You know, you have, you know, a couple of thousand dollars, you can build a whole school. And, you know, here you're lucky to, what can you get for a couple of thousand dollars in education department in America? You can't even get the school painted. So it makes a big impact, the money. A little bit of money makes a big impact in Burma. So much so that the Foundation for the People of Burma, part of their struggle as a foundation is the amount of money they need to, if they're going to have staff, the amount of money they pay for their staff people living in San Francisco could be used to, you know, support, you know, supporting one person in this country, in San Francisco, and in non-profit wages could, you know, support 10 full-time nurses for a year in Burma. So what's the trade-off? So that's kind of their struggle. So they have apparently 1.5 staff people and a lot of volunteers to kind of make this all work for themselves. So, you know, I'm extremely grateful for Burma, and been wanting to do something for Burma for a long time. We did a benefit for the Foundation for the People of Burma many years ago, but 10 years ago, when we were still in Palo Alto. And I've been wanting to do one since, especially after the difficulties last September, when the monks rose up and protested the government. And was looking for an opportunity. I thought we'd have a special kind of benefit evening or something. But then after this tragedy that happened recently in Burma, I felt, oh, I can't wait anymore. Let's just do Sunday morning dedicated to that. So all the donations you make today will go directly, all of it will go to the Foundation for the People of Burma and to their good work. So if you'd like to be part of that, that would be lovely. Any questions about that?
Is there a website?
Is there a website? Probably. Yes, there is. Yeah, there is. Yeah, there's a website.
There's also
Foundation. It's called, is there several flyers and things?
New flyer. On the general literature table that has all the information.
Okay. Oh, yes, the people listening. Foundation, it's called foundationburma.org. Foundation for the People of Burma. And Jack Kornfield on the board. So, you know, it's a very closely connected. And the current president of the board is their president. Spirit Rock Board is their president. And the former president of the board is now their treasurer. This former president of Spirit Rock's board of directors is now the treasurer of this. So there's a kind of close connection. It's kind of nice. I like it. I'm very fond of supporting organizations where there's a kind of a personal connection and knowing of the people involved. I like the human touch, the human connection that goes on there. I believe in that, when you feel the humanity that travels that way. So, did you, Steve?
Oh, I was just wondering, can donations could be made to that, for those of us who forgot our checkbooks this morning, will there be a second chance?
So those of you who didn't bring a checkbook, you could either give us a check later and we'll pass it on to them, or you could do it directly to them, or there's on the website, there's opportunities to donate, you know, directly on the website. Yes?
Not that I want to incite all kinds of pride in our own giving, but it would be really useful to know how much an American dollar translates into whatever the currency is in Burma. Do you have any idea?
I don't know anymore. It's been so long since I've been there. I was there 23 years ago. So I don't know how... Anybody been there recently and knows how many kyats to a dollar? Nowadays?
Just trying to figure out how much bang for your buck you get.
Oh, lots.
Yeah.
And especially if they can,
change
it on the black market.
Yes.
Or maybe in Burma, they should call it the white market. And also, this foundation also does things on the border, the Thai-Burmese border. There's a lot of refugees there living there on the border who are struggling. You know, the Thais don't really integrate them or take them in, and they're left there in poverty on the border. So this organization also helps these refugees, people who've... You know. So after that, a Dharma talk, a little one. And the talk is a little bit inspired by this idea, though you have to be wait a little bit to get the point, perhaps. I want to teach you a word, a Pali word. It's actually two words. It's the positive, the word, and its opposite. So the word is kinsha. Kinsha. I don't promise that I pronounce it exactly right, but kinsha. And kinsha simply means something. Not a very technical word. Something in Pali. And with the negative prefix a, it becomes akinsha, which means nothing. And it said that someone who is awakened, fully awakened, has nothing, is akinsha. And I've heard of a monk whose name is akinsha, because you know sometimes you give names, Buddhist names, that are kind of speak to some principle, some idea. So someone who's awakened has nothing. And so I love this idea myself. And maybe some of you are frightened when you hear this idea. Having nothing? What's good about that? That's frightening. I need to have all my stuff and protection. But to have nothing. And one of the remarkable things of my time in practicing in Burma was having this little room, monastic cell, that I had, that I did most of my meditation practice alone in this room. And I was there for 8 months, and 8 months without in silence. The only time I really talked to anyone was 6 days a week. I have a 10-minute interview with my teacher. And otherwise, there was no conversation, no talking. I just practiced alone. Often I did my walking meditation in my room as well. It was a little bit longish room, so I could do that. But sometimes I did in the hallway that was outside. And I was as happy sitting there in that room as I've ever been any other time in my life. I don't think I can find another time I was as happy. And I was happy having nothing. You know, I didn't have, a television. I didn't have a radio. I didn't have a credit card. It was pre-credit cards for me. I guess they had them, but I hardly had any money when I was there in Burma, anywhere, and even the bank. I don't have a bank account in America. I had just some traveler checks with me, and I didn't have entertainment. I didn't have a real social contact with people. You know, many of the things that people think are really important, in their life, and they feel depressed if they don't have it. I didn't have, and I was happy. Does that make me weird? So on Friday, we had a visit here with a prison chaplain, and he did an exercise with the people in the Buddhist chaplaincy training program, where he handed out a piece of paper and said to write down three small things that you'd like to have with you in prison, that you kind of have with you, kind of have on your shelf or something next to your bed, something that really has importance for you, that's maybe reasonable you could have there in the prison. And so everyone thought for a while, carefully, what they want to have. And they wrote down their three things. And then he collected them in a basket. And then he had them in his hand, in his basket. And he started talking about just life in the prison cell and all that, and kind of holding this. And then without any ceremony, without any explanation or anything, he just turned the basket over behind him and dumped it into a trash can behind him. And then continued talking like nothing had happened. And everybody, it was just a little exercise, but, you know. And it's understandable that, you know, people have mementos, things to remind them of home, things to remind them of things, valuable things, a variety of things that people might have there. And they're kind of shocked to have that pulled away. And I dutifully also wrote some things I want to have there, if I could. And they were dumped away like everything else. But I reflected a lot about this, and I thought really that the thing that I, oddly enough, maybe I don't think it's odd, that I value the most is nothing, having nothing. That there's something very profound and meaningful about that space of nothing, of not having anything. There's something about having things, which as wonderful as might be, much pleasure and security and inspiration we can get from something, for me, there's a greater inspiration from having nothing. And so how to explain that to you to get it across? Maybe if you are hungry, it's really good to eat. You want to eat. You want something to eat, right? And then sometimes you might eat and you overeat. And then you know you've overeaten. Ugh, how could I have done that? And there's something really perfect about having just enough food in your belly that you're not hungry and you don't feel like you have too much. And in a sense, in that kind of state, you forget about your belly. It kind of disappears. For the few moments, a few minutes or whatever, it's nothing. Or if it's too hot or too cold, it's really cold, it feels really good to go someplace where it's warm. But if it gets too warm, then it's too warm. It's uncomfortable and you won't go someplace cool. And some of the relief or the pleasure of going into a warm place after cold or a cold place after warm is the contrast. But the contrast wears off after a while. Or you forget the contrast. And it's really wonderful when the temperature is just right and you're kind of not aware of the temperature. Just nothing there. So we're suffering. And it makes sense if you suffer to want something, to want relief from suffering. But when the suffering disappears, then there's no more desire for the relief because, you know, it's gone. It's already there, no longer there. And so how much of the motivation do we have in order to have things in our life comes from suffering? And if the underlying suffering disappears, will the desire for, a home or a good job or security or relationship or all kind of things that people want, what happens to that when the underlying anxiety, the underlying feeling of emptiness, the underlying feeling of this greed falls away? What happens to that? And there's not a few people I know who, as their suffering has diminished, have found that they're happier, or they can be quite happy having very little. And so there's a kind of phenomena which we don't advertise very publicly about Buddhism in the West here. But the number of Buddhists who encounter, their encounter in Buddhism has made them downwardly mobile. Now, isn't that good? not because Buddhism impoverishes them, but rather they choose different values to live by. And a lot of the kind of things of getting, having more and more and more, that sometimes seems to be contagious in the society, doesn't kind of interest them anymore. And they have other interests. And it can be actually a much greater luxury to go spend a day sitting in an open space preserve going for a hike than it is to get the latest, greatest, flat screen television. And in fact, to spend a day in a nice weather in an open space preserve for a hike is kind of priceless in a way that, watching television is not. So is there capacity to discover something really beneficial, something wonderful, marvelous, inspiring in that space of nothing? And that's there's something there. but that something is a strange thing. Because it's certainly possible, I think, to imagine or feel or know from experience how the tremendous sense of well-being that can come when our normal everyday concerns drop away. Some people it happens on vacation, or people go hiking in the mountains, for something. And after a day or two or some days, the normal concerns and worries and frettings and stuff falls away. And even things that you didn't know were concerns or things that were important for you fall away also. Issues of identity, issues of trying to please people or protect yourself from people, or a variety of things fall away. And there can be this sense of well-being can settle in, not because you're getting something, but because you've unwound so thoroughly and completely, you've dropped so much. And when you've dropped so much, a sense of well-being that wells up, in a sense, wells up because there's nothing there. It's almost as if you leave yourself alone completely enough, your body, your system, is made, set up to feel good. Isn't that kind of a strange thing? But then so much of our culture doesn't give us that message. I've thought sometimes that we should have IMC should dedicate some of its money to buying a big billboard on 101 that would say, "Don't buy, you'll be happier." or something like that. I don't know if that's the right wording. Don't buy. because that message, I haven't seen that message yet. driving down 101 on the billboards. And of course, we need to buy things, food and stuff. But we don't want to take this to extremes. But I think the principle that we can be happy with so little is one that's not taught enough in our culture. And I think it's one of the teachings of Buddhism, and in particular exemplified in the model of Buddhist monastics, is a life of feeling deeply contented, peaceful, happy, with nothing. Anyway, it's easy to see how there can be a sense of well-being, perhaps easy to, when things fall away, a lot of things fall away. But it gets more strange. More challenging. And it's exemplified. Western Buddhists sometimes like the Alice in Wonderland story of the cat. Is it Cheshire cat? The cat disappears, all you see is a smile. Well, this is like great for meditators. Because as you meditate, all that's left is a smile at some point. Things start disappearing, falling away. Get so calm, so peaceful. A lot of concerns fall away, a lot of past and the future fall away temporarily while you're there. The body gets more comfortable, more relaxed. At some point in deep meditation, the sense of the body disappears. And what's left is a smile or something like that, sense of well-being, sense of joy. It's all that's left. Isn't that great? And then the smile disappears. Now, at some point the well-being disappears. Or say a different way, at some point you, as the person experiencing the well-being, disappears. What good is it for you then, if you're not there to have it? It's because, so much, in Buddhism, one of the primary forms of suffering is a suffering around having caught up in a sense of self-identity. Caught up with a localized sense of self. Here I am. And often a sense of wanting to improve our lives, develop ourselves, have things go well, feel happy, be free of suffering, is often done from the reference point of this localized individual kind of identity. It's a reasonable one to have. It's not like bad, necessarily bad to have it. It's reasonable. It comes with the territory. But it's an activity of the mind. It's not needed all times. And so as practice matures and deepens, that sense of a self that's the recipient of experiences or the agent, the initiator of experiences, falls away. It falls away with that smile. So, but at that point, it isn't like something terrible has fallen, something wonderful has fallen away, and you fall into some kind of dark abyss. When the smile goes away, it actually gets even better. It gets more peaceful, more sublime. So, it gets more sublime, more peaceful, when the sense of self, who experiences all this, falls away. But then, what good does it do to you? I mean, you know, what point is it? What point to have a wonderful experience if you're not there to have it? And but I think it's just really great. It's really the best. And so you're not asked to kind of give something up that it's not clear that giving up is beneficial. But as practice matures, at some point it's seen that there's something here that's not beneficial that'd be useful to let go of. And some of that has to do with the sense of this individual sense of identity. Here I am. And I'm the person who's the agent. I'm the one who's the person experiencing everything. At some point, it just seems, oh, this is obvious. This is not useful anymore. It's not helpful. It's actually irritating or something, or awkward, or suffering is part of it. And then it's a little bit hard to talk about what happens after that, because if you're not there to experience it, then how can you? Usual language kind of doesn't work so well. I kind of liken it to trying to take your right hand and touching your right elbow. You know it's there, but you can't quite touch it. So this freedom is there for sure, but you can't quite touch it with the usual ways in which we experience things. So it's a little bit awkward. But it's just as well, because if we could touch it, we would sell it. Don't buy. And so the reason why I wanted to talk about this today is that having nothing, being someone who has nothing, doesn't really leave us as a nobody in some ways. It leaves us as a nobody, but what it does is it makes us much more responsive to the world that we encounter. And so we're much more able to respond, or not able, but just, it isn't like we respond then. Oh, it's a good idea for me to respond, you know, people see well in me, or I need to be a good person, I need to respond and do good things. It's more like when we're empty, when we're kind of in this healthy, very healthy kind of nothing. It's a healthy nothing. There's unhealthy nothings. So you understand that, right? I hope you understand that. Because there are people in our society who are get the message that they're nothing. And it's devastating. It's a horrible message. So I'm talking about a healthy nothing. And if you believe you're nothing, that's a something. So to really have nothing, you can't even have the nothing. So the response comes out of that space. It isn't like I'm responding. Response is what happens. And some of you, I think all of you, have had the experience, I think, of helping someone, and it was unpremeditated. It was just spontaneous in the moment. This is what needed to happen. Someone trips on the sidewalk next to you, and your hand goes out to help them up. Just, you know, no thought about it at all. And so the system, the way the human body is built, I think it has innate biological capacities for compassion, for empathy, for action, responding. And it isn't like this mystical, spiritual thing to respond out of compassion. I think it's hardwired into our kind of our brain to have that happen. And we give it a chance to operate when we don't color it or cloud it over with all our neurosis and anxiety and fears and desires and greeds and all the stuff that goes on. So the more empty we get, the more the response is there. And some of you are parents, and perhaps parents can get a sense of this, that there's a health. I think sometimes in parenting, I felt this, there was a healthy way where when I had my kids, that I didn't count anymore. In a way, in other situations, I would have counted. I would have taken care of myself. But taking care of myself and just didn't, it just like wasn't relevant. It was like this kid was important. You know, 2 o'clock at night, the kid is throwing up. My sleep, I need my sleep. You know, I could think that way. But it just is irrelevant. It just disappears, my sleep. You know, the kid's throwing up. It's just, I'm there. And it's not like matter, you know, do I want to? Or should I? Or is it, you know, it's just like, well, you know, this is what's happening. So when I was at the Zen monastery, at one point, I walked up to my Zen teacher and said to him, I'm becoming a response machine. Now, that's not a very good image, becoming a machine. So it wasn't a good choice of words, but it was the best I could think of at that moment. Meaning that the idea of machine for me, this idea was that what I was becoming was something, somebody, that just responded spontaneously, or responded freely, automatically to the circumstances around me. As I became more empty, as I became less self-preoccupied, but what it was replaced with was this ability to respond. And I think to respond is a beautiful thing when we respond from this empathy and compassion. And the movement for people to help in this society, in this world, is most effective when the helping comes from that kind of place of nothing, when we're not trying to do something for ourselves in the process. There's nothing wrong with doing something for oneself. There can be something wrong with it, but it doesn't inherently wrong to do something for oneself. And I think all of us will do it appropriately that way at times. But what I'm trying to say is, as we mature spiritually or through Buddhist practice, there comes a healthy and appropriate time where naturally we feel like, oh, it's just response is happening through us, as opposed to, I'm the one doing it. It's very important not to jump the gun and pretend that you're nothing, and pretend that you're spontaneously kind of responding to what's going on. That's having a lot of something. And so so the protection from that is just the mindfulness practice. That we just keep being very honestly mindful and honest about what's actually going on for us, what motivates us, what's happening here, our feelings, sensations, and all that. And then we know, and we're honest with what's there. That's really the path. And if we do that path, then with time, the cat disappears, and we're left with just a smile. And then when you feel when it's just the right thing, just the best thing that could possibly happen, you let the smile go. Isn't that good? So to have nothing. And so I wish all of you can discover how beautiful, how happy, how peaceful, how spectacular it is to breathe easily, sit quietly, and have nothing. No needs, nothing to prove, nothing to defend against, just to be. It's just really good. And as we do that, let's help the people in Burma. So thank you.